welcome and thank you so much for tuning into the Psychology Is podcast. I am Nick Fortino, and today my guest is Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, and I'm excited to talk to you about the topic of transformation. This is an area that I have done a little bit of my own research in, which I hadn't even mentioned to you, I don't think, when we were organizing this, but I leaned on the research that you conducted in association with the Institute of Noetic Sciences and recently conducted a study on transformation. And so you've written the book, among many books, Living Deeply, The Art and Science of Transformation in Everyday Life. And I read that, and it's a very enjoyable read. You have just many profound insights from contemplative scholars, and then also very clearly lay out your research findings. And I'll, in a moment, ask you to describe that research and say a little bit more about your background. But first, let me just hear your voice, Dr. Schlitz. How are you today?
I'm really good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
Research and what you've discovered. And I think I might have cut you off when you were going to do an intro.
That's okay. That's okay.
Okay. Sorry.
I wanted to hear your voice before I said too much, but let me give you that intro. So I'll read it off here. So you are an acclaimed social scientist, award-winning author, and charismatic public speaker. You've conducted clinical laboratory and field-based research into consciousness, human transformation, and healing, which in my opinion are three of the juiciest topics that there are. Your books include the one I mentioned, Living Deeply, as well as Consciousness and Healing, and Death Makes Life Possible. And then you've taught at Stanford, Harvard, Trinity University, and you currently teach at Sophia University in Palo Alto, California. Senior fellow and at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, published hundreds of articles in scholarly journals and popular publications, and you've lectured extensively at diverse venues, including the United Nations, and you're gracing us with your presence now. So let's see where the conversation takes us, but I'd like to start with you just defining for us the term noetic science. People heard me say the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and this is a term that I think some people have heard but don't quite know what it means. So can you explain, what is noetic science?
I would be delighted and happy to be here with you. So noetic is a beautiful word, and it comes originally from the ancient Greek, nous. So it was a term that was used to describe a state of knowing as compared to rational discursive intellect, you know, where we reason things through. This was the kind of knowing that comes to us intuitively or directly. And the word was used in different ways over time. And I think the most beautiful definition really comes from William James, the philosopher. And it was at the turn of the century, late 1800s. And he described noetic as states of insight, unplumbed by the discursive intellect, all inarticulate though they remain, and yet they carry a certain sense of authority. And, you know, that prose that was so common during that time by the intellectuals of, you know, that persuasion is so beautiful. And then, you know, he had done a masterful job of really looking at the nature of internal states. And it was something that was fairly controversial because materialism and rationalism, positivism, reductionism were all taking control over mainstream psychology. And so here was a psychologist who was still interested in those aspects of our humanity that are like hard to articulate. Mm. So then just the next piece was that Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut, went to the moon, and he had an epiphany coming back. And it was kind of a two-pronged epiphany. One was he looked out at this beautiful planet Earth, And he saw it in all its pristine glory. And he thought, there's no divisions. There's no sense of, national boundaries, state boundaries, race boundaries, cultural boundaries. None of that existed. And so that gave him this epiphany that, the source of suffering isn't coming from planet Earth, but it comes from us, the inhabitants of planet Earth. And so maybe what was needed is a kind of worldview shift, the kind of awe moment that he had coming back from the moon. And then he had a second piece to his epiphany, which was he realized that all the molecules in the universe, in the solar system, that originated from the Big Bang were in him and were in his colleagues who were sitting in this tiny metal capsule hurtling through space. And it gave him this sense of interconnectedness. And he was an MIT trained engineer. He didn't have a vocabulary for any of these experiences. And so when he came back successfully to planet Earth, he started a little journey, his own transformative process. And he went and interviewed people. And, as an astronaut, he had access to a lot of places at that point. And he ultimately called it a Sumadhi experience, the unitive consciousness experience. And he decided he wanted to dedicate the rest of his career to studying that and to understanding consciousness and worldview. And so he formed the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and that bridged that sense of this ineffable quality that William James described with then the rigor and sophistication that Edgar and the Apollo program epitomized. So it's a beautiful story, and it's a wonderful concept.
And it seems to me that the Institute of Noetic Sciences continues to thrive.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not overly involved with them anymore. I left probably almost 10 years ago. I went to make a film with Deepak Chopra, and I'd kind of completed my journey there. The people I had originally come in with were all gone, like literally. And so it was time to do something else. And I, moved on from there. And I'm now a professor at Sophia University, where we study transpersonal psychology, which is very compatible with the noetic sciences. So I feel like I've kind of on my, I'm on my Dharma path, and it feels coherent and it feels very fruitful.
Transpersonal psychology is I also studied that. I did my PhD program at Sophia, and yet I still don't find it easy to clearly articulate what transpersonal psychology is. Some of the phrases that I personally like are the full spectrum psychology, or the psychology of non-ordinary states and transformative experience and processes. And also it's, and I want to hear you say it too. I'm just sharing my thoughts. But when you look at all these different subfields of psychology, the subfield partially defines what the subject matter is that it is most interested in, but it also defines what the framework is that they're bringing into it. And so, the framework of a transpersonal psychologist, as I understand it, as I have adopted it, is to understand an individual as being more than an ego, more than an individual distinct entity, and truly interconnected to everything on Earth, and also even interconnected to perhaps that which we can't quite detect with our senses, something that is transcendent. So that to me is kind of a framework you can bring into almost any topic. And then the topics, of course, of transpersonal psychology are, like I mentioned, these non-ordinary states. Transpersonal psychologists, I feel, really pioneered what is now one of the hottest topics in psychology, which is the effects of meditation, the effects of many of these, what are known as Eastern traditions. So that's kind of been the subject matter. But anyway, how do you tend to describe transpersonal psychology?
Well, I want to use what you just said and play it to my students, because that was great. That was a beautiful overview of the transpersonal. And you know, I really appreciate the depth of your own studies and inquiry into this. I like to think about, you know, this notion of self-actualization and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, that is the idea that we can aspire to the fullness of our human potentials. And so that's kind of the big vision of it. And what I think often gets neglected, but I think you referenced, is this idea of self-transcendence. So, you know, the whole self-actualization piece is really about my own personal development. But once you move into that self-transcendence, it's what you said, it's that sense of beyond ego. And I'm just giving a talk at a Beyond the Brain conference for the Scientific and Medical Network. And I just wrote my blurb yesterday. And it was really about taking kind of the last part of what you said, which is, you know, this can apply to anything. And I'm going to talk about how this transpersonal, but in particular, self-transcendence is really applicable to the great social problems we're facing today, you know, and if we could begin to see past the individual differences and those personal boundaries, I think it would help a lot in many domains.
Amen. Yes, indeed. Well, that's beautiful. Hopefully I can listen to that talk. So I know that this book that I just mentioned, Living Deeply, was published in 2007. And I'm asking you to kind of reflect on some research that was published over 13 years ago. But hopefully, I mean, I trust that it's kind of readily available in your mind. And so the first thing I want to do is actually read a little passage from the beginning of the book here. I just feel like it's powerful and it sets the stage nicely. So what you wrote here is, our decade of research on transformation has found that dramatic and lasting change for the better springs from radically shifting your perspective of who you are. Great external changes often come out of this shift in perspective. You may well find that as meaning and purpose become more clear to you, things that are out of alignment in your life gradually or sometimes quickly fall away. But the most fundamental change is within you. It is a profound shift in your perspective, where you direct your attention and your intention. The most essential change, the one from which all other changes spring, is a change in your worldview and your perception of what's possible. Transforming your consciousness may be the most important thing you can do for yourself and the world. So perhaps we can just have you elaborate on what it means to change your perspective of who you are.
Yeah, well, I think it's a hard thing. And I also think it's one of the most fundamental tools or kinds of literacy that we can develop. So out of the work that we did on Living Deeply, we created a curriculum on worldview and kind of coined this term worldview literacy. And the idea really is that we all walk around with this set of glasses, and those are our worldviews, and they inform everything about how we perceive ourselves, how we perceive others, how we position ourselves in the world. And yet it's usually invisible. In fact, it's almost entirely invisible. And most people aren't even aware that they have one. And so we've got this powerful force that's influencing everything, and we're not aware of it. So how do we bring that perception into our consciousness? And then the second piece really is to recognize that other people have different worldviews, and that there are, you know, skills and capacities, ways of being that can be helpful in trying to understand and appreciate these differences. And then, you know, finally, what kind of actions do we take in the world once we've had these kind of awarenesses that, you know, we're being almost driven on autopilot a lot of the time? And another piece of these worldviews is the role of biases. So there are all these implicit biases that happen, and they influence our behavior, and we're jostled around, we're informed and influenced by, you know, the media, the news, the educational system, religion, family, all this stuff. And yet again, it's below our threshold of awareness. So I think the first piece of this transformation is, you know, the emergence of that awareness. And it's not simple. And the whole idea that somebody would want to have a transformation, you know, it's not often something that people just say, well, I'm going to change. I'm going to change my worldview. Yes, sir. You know, it's usually not that. It's usually triggered by, you know, some kind of big problem, big challenge, big disruption in our life. You know, that's really what I think can trigger these transformations. It's something that destabilizes the steady state. It causes us to reflect, just maybe even for a second, on, you know, is there something bigger than what I have been perceiving? But these biases can come in and they can limit our capacity, even if we've had an awakening, even if we've had some kind of disruption. They can just shut it back down and say, no, we're, you know, perfectly careful, happy living in this steady state that isn't happiness. It isn't fullness. So yeah, that's the project that we did on transformation, you know, was really impactful for a lot of people, all the people that we interviewed, certainly us as we were collecting the data. And then we had a group of people who took every interview. So we interviewed 60 masters from different world traditions, and we gave them a set of questions. There were 20 questions. And so after we were all done collecting the data, we trained a group of people. They started to call themselves a Sangha, on how to code these interviews. And they would work together in teams, and they would discuss it. And they went line by line through all these deep, you know, profound wisdom teachers interviews. And it was out of that that, you know, we discovered the patterns that we developed in the book, Living Deeply. And then ultimately, you know, how do you translate that into some kind of educational program? And today I teach it as something called Emerging Worldviews, where, you know, I have created a series of exercises and practices. So it can help people to become more aware.
Beautiful. And something I think about often is just the role of perception in psychology. And I think that the role of perception can't be understated, or can't, actually, I should say, it can't be overstated. You can't even exaggerate how central the role of perception is in the way life feels, right? Because perception is, you know, technically often it's defined as the selection and interpretation of external and internal stimuli. But what's crucial to understand is not only is it the selection, in that it's not only just what gets filtered in of all the data possibly streaming into our brains, only a sliver of it is becoming conscious, but along with what is actually being noticed, what you're becoming conscious of, it's how you become aware of it. It's how you interpret it. And so therefore, the instant you become aware of something, it has already passed through the filter of your worldview, of your perceptual set, of all the psychological factors that influence perception. And then, so if there's any kind of significant change to that worldview, to that filter through which you perceive the world, in a sense, everything feels different. It can be as radical as almost every moment feeling quite different. And I don't want to hog the mic here, but I'll just also add that two things. I like to think of transformation, and honestly, reading your book helped me frame it in this way, as going from basically an equilibrium through disequilibrium to a new equilibrium. And it's very interesting to study what portals, like you say, there are to transformation, or what catalyzes this movement into a disequilibrium, to where a caterpillar is being liquefied, to where things are no longer feeling normal. There's no clear default state. And then what factors facilitate the process toward a new equilibrium? So that's just one thought. And as we kind of fill out this idea of what it means to transform, and then the other thought, back to the topic of perception, is in my experience and in what I understand about it, perception gives rise to emotion, and then emotion fuels behavior. And then, of course, it's more complex than that, because it kind of all loops back to that a perception can give rise to an emotion, but an emotional state can also prime perception. So it's all very connected, but I see perception really at the heart of psychology. And so when you talk about the factors that affect perception and how those factors, like your worldview, can change, it can lead to dramatic and lasting changes, which is transformation.
And which is transpersonal psychology.
There you go. Nice. Yeah. Let me ask you a series of questions here, and I want you to do more of the talking at this point. But as philosophical as this is, how would you articulate what consciousness is and what it means to undergo a transformation of consciousness?
Well, consciousness for me is perception. Yeah, it's awareness. It's what we are aware of. And so there's all this other stuff that's happening below that, which really, as I've said, I think drives the show. So a shift in consciousness can be very tiny. I think you kind of alluded to that. I tend to now kind of focus on what are the least amount of things one can do in order to just subtly change their perceptions. So it can be turn off the TV, decide for this hour, I'm not going to watch the news. Or it can be going out into nature and, really studying a tree and seeing the new shoots of life, and bringing that sense of curiosity and wonder and awe. And if you can shift your perception from just, it's nice out here, to like, well, I'm going to really appreciate the beauty that's manifesting right in front of me. That's a perception shift. And it requires a consciousness shift, because it requires that we choose where we're going to place our attention. So there is the intention that we bring to it. And then there is that sense that we can begin to develop and nurture what we're paying attention to. So it's kind of, those are the two aspects. And then, when we did the study, we came up with kind of a little model of transformation that, included the triggers, those catalysts that, kind of launch us to want to kind of change perception. It could be a loss of a job or the death of a loved one, or, it can be something really euphoric and wonderful. It's usually something that can, as you said, it's like in cybernetics, you move to a higher state and then you start to sort of set those boundary conditions. And, the problem is that you can become reified wherever you are. So even if you've had a little perception change, you can kind of get stuck there. So we then talked about this kind of cultivation of curiosity, the journey. I'd like to learn more. I'd like to figure out what just happened to me, that kind of thing. And that can have its pitfalls, because we can get into this endless seeking. I'm never going to ground myself if I'm constantly looking for the answer out there somewhere beside me. And then there's this idea of intention. I begin to see that I'd like to develop a practice. I'd like to formalize, these ideas. So people talk about these transformative practices. The masters all talked about them, and yet they talked about them in different ways. Obviously, you know, we interviewed a pagan witch and a Catholic priest. You know, they have very different viewpoints, and everybody in between, you know, all kinds of traditions. It was a really remarkable journey. So the elements of the practice were setting intention, and then shifting your attention. So is the glass half empty or is it half full? And these different mindfulness practices that you mentioned can be very helpful. I can begin to shift my attention from those things that cause me to feel reactive to those things that allow me to recognize the agency behind that reactivity, you know, so I'm shifting my perspective. Yeah. And then there was repetition. So building new habits, just like, you know, anything else, you know, our brains lay down these neural pathways and they become these grooves in the snow and it's very hard to change them. But fortunately we know now about neuroplasticity and, you know, with the right boundary conditions, we can begin to build new habits. And, you know, one of the things we were looking for with the teachers was, you know, what is that path? And what are those practices that can help to build those new habits? And then there was guidance. All of the teachers talked about the importance of guidance. 99% of them had some teacher that had influenced them, or, you know, maybe it was a book, maybe it was a podcast, maybe it was your podcast. And, you know, there was something that triggered a thought and invited that kind of curiosity. And there's the difference too between the external source of authority and the internal. So part of this consciousness transformation is beginning to cultivate that inner territory for the authority that's coming from within us. And then there is this idea of acceptance that, you know, we can't necessarily change what's happening in the outer world. What we can change is our reaction to it and our response to it. And so the living deeply concept was really coming to a sense of peace with that, purpose with that. And, you know, also the acceptance of our own mortality and our, you know, our sense of the inevitability of our death. And that makes life more full. So all of those became elements of what we were trying to distill. And then the final thing I'll say is, you know, the ambition is really a full systems shift, that we cultivate these capacities within us, but as agents of change can be, you know, nurtured in various systems, whether it's education or healthcare or business or community, you know, we may be able to help facilitate a kind of larger worldview transformation.
So a couple questions come to my mind, and I'll share that in the research that I mentioned that I did with my team, so what we did was we had a survey. It was a mixed method study that started with a survey of 130 people. And then the plan was to do qualitative interviews with the group who had answered whatever the most frequently chosen catalyst of transformation turned out to be, which turned out to be trauma or emotional distress. And by quite a landslide, interestingly, it was like 43% of people in the whole survey chose that as the primary catalyst of their transformation, what started the change. But of course, that's, you know, and then the other options that we gave were, inspiration. So whether it was an inspirational experience or inspirational person that you encountered, integration, basically, or dissonance, feeling that you are not who you can be, feeling inconsistent or discrepant within yourself. And that discrepancy, as we know with the idea of cognitive dissonance, can compel a person to seek inner consistency. And then also adaptation, which we defined as basically you started to change because the circumstances you were in essentially demanded that of you. You had to adapt to new circumstances. So those were kind of the the main catalysts, which were inspired by your data, and the inspiration and integration and adaptation were really even in terms of how many people selected those, but then trauma was a landslide, the majority. So then we interviewed people about that process. And in a way, the second stage of the research, the interview phase, started to become about what some people call the process of post-traumatic growth, which I think is a variation of transformation. And so just wanted to share that, I guess, and provide that context so that I can relate to what you're talking about by referring to some of that. And I'll keep, you know, talking about some of our findings. But first, I want to ask you, there's the catalyst, there's whatever kind of initiates this process of change. And then there's a bunch of factors that come into play that facilitate the process. And I think that's what you were speaking to with intention, attention, guidance, repetition. But I think many people have this experience where they have a significant experience that starts to catalyze a change, and they start maybe exploring that, but they end up defaulting back to what is comfortable, what was normal. So how do you understand that? And what would you say to a person who finds that no matter how significant experience is that they're having, they always end up just kind of defaulting back to their old patterns? What would be some helpful guidance you would offer for a person who's experiencing that?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think positive growth and change requires effort. It's just not that simple. I mean, once in a while you hear these stories that somebody just suddenly, but it's rare. It really is rare that we can just become that person we idealize, mm-hmm. you know, that person that we most want to become. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's the beauty of stumbling and making mistakes, is that, you know, we're kind of like those rocks in the tumbler, and we're working on becoming a little smoother. And every time we tumble a little more, we become a little smoother. And, you know, aging obviously is a great factor, and the sort of wisdom that comes from a little bit more longitudinal perspective. Mm-hmm. That's one of the beauties of aging. You know, I think it's really a matter of recognizing we have these defense mechanisms. They're very powerful. All of these biases and the forces of our psychology and our society that work against us becoming our best selves. And so it does require effort. Having a community can be really great. And, you know, just like this podcast, if people can hear things and maybe it triggers a little something, an idea, like, yeah, I'd like to try that myself. You know, and I hear about those things when, you know, I'm traveling around or, you know, talking. And then, you know, I go back to the little things. Like, if you want to really start to invite this process, I think that you have to recognize there's certain qualities that you'd like to have, like gratefulness. Gratefulness becomes a fundamental skill set so that you can begin to reframe those traumatic experiences into those growth experiences that you were describing. I think that's a great one. You know, obviously compassion, empathy, learning to become hardy and resilient. Recognizing that, again, the tumbling is an advantage. We can place that on the good list, you know, instead of our regret list. It's little things, and it's incremental, and it helps to have a community to support it. Mm.
And some, you know, people listening might think, and I've had the thought myself of, you know, transformation, we're talking about this significant lasting change to your whole way of being and your worldview and your way of perceiving and your emotional patterns and your behavioral patterns. And yet someone might think, on one hand, we're always changing. Life is never static, really. So how do we differentiate the just natural course of change over life from transformation? And, you know, you can add your own input onto that, but I certainly think of it of transformation. Like I think of it as a change that is certainly not developmentally inevitable. Like you could say, based on our criteria of transformation, that puberty is a transformation. And in a sense, it is, but we're talking about something different because puberty is very biologically driven and it's developmentally inevitable. It's going to happen to everybody. But transformation is something that, to me, if it didn't happen, the person wouldn't be considered as though they were developing abnormally. You know, they're still developing normally through life, but some people sometimes experience a relatively accelerated process of change that to me has a very relative, but a relative beginning, middle, and end. And again, the end is super relative, but I do think that changes can stabilize, that traits can get integrated, and that we can kind of come to the other side of transformation. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I wonder what's on the other side of transformation.
I suppose
the state of bliss and enlightenment, and you don't worry about it anymore, so you're not trying. Mm-hmm. That would be nice. Mm-hmm. You know, people describe experiences that shake them up, like a near-death experience, very widely reported, and it can be revelatory for people. They suddenly see their own existence in a new way, or they see the prospects of their own death in a new way, less frightening. And I do believe death anxiety is a huge cause of pathology in our culture, that people are just really so in denial that they take, you know, these kind of aberrant behaviors and begin to manifest in really asocial ways. But yeah, transformation, it is an integral growth. It is something different than the biological changes. You can see somebody, you know, they have this arrested development. The person gets kind of stuck and never really grows out of that. All of those things happen and, you know, the biology changes, but they haven't really had an identity shift and they don't really see themselves differently. Or maybe they don't need to. You know, I talked to a gentleman the other day who was like, you know, this stuff is all like, wow, to me, like, I don't get it. But here's a guy who was like super into service, very generous about his time and his dedication to society and to educating children. And, you know, he was very inspiring. So, you know, maybe this kind of language is only for a certain subset of the population, and that really it is about kind of those virtues. How do we live into the qualities that we want to see in ourselves? You know, we want to be kinder, we want to be more forgiving, we want to be more generous. And the work comes when all of a sudden we go, miss that one. How can I reframe that? Even if I can't redo it, how can I recognize that there's something valuable in that? But I think in a certain way, we reify these things in this kind of discourse. And like I said, you know, there are people in my work looking at different spiritual and religious traditions, you know, people who are just going about their daily life, but they're doing it with a sense of purpose, of loving kindness to something. It is that self-transcendence. And you see it in people who don't even have any vocabulary like what we're talking about. And, you know, that's the beauty. That's the reassuring thing when you can find that spark in somebody's eyes that, you know, they don't have high education and fancy vocabularies, but they have the transmission somehow.
Yes. Yeah. And the other, so I'm curious to know, you know, your thoughts on this and whether this came up in your data at all, but specifically when the portal to transformation is pain, when what disrupts our equilibrium is a tragedy or a trauma or something painful, when that's the case, what factors promote the healing process? And, you know, a very simple way for people to think about this idea of post-traumatic growth is that if you can, you know, people who are watching can see my hand, some people are just listening, so this will still make sense. But if you imagine just your normal sort of baseline, your range of emotions and averaging out at a baseline, and then you experience this traumatic experience and there's this big dip in your baseline functioning, it becomes very difficult to continue functioning. And then throughout the process of recovery and healing, that line starts to move up again. And if it gets back to that initial baseline, we can call that recovery. But sometimes the line goes higher than the initial baseline. And that is what is typically referred to as post-traumatic growth. You essentially, through the process of healing, grew and matured and transformed your worldview compared to before. And so the psychology of that line going up, I think, is very important to understand. So my question to you right now is, what do you think are some really helpful factors, whether they be behaviors or socially provided factors, that help people on that line back up?
Well, you know, it's healing, right? So healing is this restoration of wholeness. But as we restore wholeness, we can reconfigure it. So there's a different persona in there, you know. Maybe they have the same core fundamental assumptions and personality attributes, but, you know, they're different. They're different. So how do we heal? How do we, you know, bring about that sense of wholeness? I talk about an integral framework for healing. And I think at each step, it can be helpful to people where we start with our own, you know, mind body, and we feel that resonance between how we can use breath, you know, to help calm the autonomic nervous system when we're anxious. We can use breath to pause when we feel reactive. When that whole amygdala hijacking thing happens and somebody cuts us off in traffic and we're just like, you breathe and it calms it. And once you're in that calmer state where you're not being reactive, then you can just bring that prefrontal cortex back into action and start making, you know, better choices. So instead of, you know, giving the guy the finger, you know, I tend to, I keep an emery board in my car. So when I'm at a red light, I don't get impatient. When I have those experiences on the road, you know, I like to think of road rage as a spiritual practice where it gives us an opportunity to sort of role play. Like, what is that person experiencing right now? Maybe they have just had a trauma. And if you can kind of do that empathy bit, I think it helps to resolve it. So there's that. Then there is the relational aspect. Healing is relational. It's fundamentally relational. And that includes the relation between our mind and body and our relationship with one another. If we're in toxic relationships, it's a good idea to reflect on that and figure out how to change that. If we are in a situation where we recognize things like placebo, you know, being in a kind of conversation with others that is nurturing, that helps us to grow and feel more healed. And there's also the nocebo, that sense that people can say things that wound us and hurt us. And, you know, figuring out where to draw the line on those kind of things. We know that, you know, committed relationships are very healing, particularly, you know, if they're a positive relationship, if people use good communication tools, that is very restorative for people. And if they then can communicate and talk with others, you know, maybe it's a therapist, maybe it's journaling, you know, journaling 10 minutes a day has been documented to be healing, health promoting, both in terms of our psychology and our immune systems. Mm-hmm. So just that expression of what is, you know, meaningful in our lives, whether it's talking to somebody or writing about it or meditating on it, can be very helpful. Mm-hmm. And then there's that sense of, you know, Ivan Illich was a great deconstructionist, and he came up with that term medical nemesis and iatrogenic illness, that you can actually get sick in the hospital. You know, that's and so how can you be healthy in a sick society? And that was, you know, a big question that he raised. And I think it's one for all of us to ponder. And that's where I say, you know, it's good to stay informed. I, you know, love to read the news, but there's a time where you got to turn it off because it's bombarding, you know, and, you know, finding little healing spaces so that you can get away from things that are painful and problematic out in the world. And then there's that relationship to the natural world. I think being in nature, again, from an evidence-based perspective, it has been documented over and over again that our relationship to animals is healing, our relationship to being in a forest is healing, our connection to the ocean is healing. And so, you know, finding time in our lives to go to those places or be in, you know, spaces, even if it's, you know, a picture of a forest or a houseplant that you're taking care of, that all of those things provide opportunities for that restoration of wholeness. And then finally, I would say, you know, there's this sense of the sacred, and again, that self-transcendence, you know, whatever the definition is of that, if we can situate ourselves in a bigger whole that isn't all about me, but is about our connection to the we in some fundamental way, that those are all very healing steps. And I think in each of those comes, you know, this prospect of transformation. So transformation is healing and healing is transformation. Mm. So yeah, I hold all of that.
Mm. And I love what you said, just leading into all of that, that healing is a restoration of wholeness, and in restoring wholeness, you can reconfigure it. That's a great way to put it. And it's interesting that, you know, so you highlighted the breath and these sort of self-regulation tools and the relational aspect of healing, whether it's the relationship within yourself, between the mind and the body, or perhaps even between various parts of yourself. And then the relationship between people and the relationship between a person and nature, and then the sense of the sacred. I love that. It's well-rounded. And two of the things that you mentioned were really stood out in the data from the study that I was describing. One of the questions we asked in our survey was, to what degree do you feel that the changes have stabilized, or that the process of transformation is relatively complete? And I know I keep really highlighting the word relatively because I want to make sure people know I understand that there's never a moment or there's a finish line and you're like, okay, now I'm officially a new person. Like it's constant change. Yet again, I think change is stabilized, and I think data indicate that changes can stabilize, states can become traits. So anyway, with that question that we asked, there was a range. Some people scored that very low, indicating they're still in the heat of change. Some people scored that very high. And we were curious about what factors correlated most closely with the people who reported a very high level of change stabilization. And the most statistically significant factor that correlated was self-expression. And so when you were talking about journaling or expressing yourself to a therapist or anyone, that and what was nice was the interviews enabled us to better understand what people meant by self-expression. And what people meant was a couple main things. One, talking about the process that they were going through, expressing themselves about that. And it also meant just being less inhibited. So it was really like three prongs. So there was talking about the process that you're going through, expressing yourself in that way. There was being more assertive, really, being more self-expressive in that sense of being willing to speak your mind and stake your ground and form your boundaries. And then it was also related to creative expression as well. But there's, you know, there's a common ground in all of that, which is I'm not inhibiting myself from expressing myself. And that turned out to be, again, highly correlated with the people with high change stabilization. So that was really surprising, actually. I hadn't expected that result, but it was strong. And then
very interesting, I think, you know, because you often hear people say, you know, I need to find my voice, or I found a voice. You know, that's kind of what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And it, just before you said that, I was thinking about authenticity.
Our mindfulness bell.
Yes, exactly. Here we are. So I have done some teaching around communication, and I called it authentic communication, and helping people to really feel more confident to express themselves. And you can watch over the course of, you know, 4 sessions, 10 sessions, just people get more ownership of their agency. And that's a beautiful process to watch. And particularly, I think, if people have experienced trauma, that there is this self-mastery. And then, you know, where the line comes, Roger Walsh. Roger Walsh said, when we were interviewing him, how do you know if somebody's transformed? Well, ask their spouse. And I, you know, it always stuck with me because I was like, you know, really, you can't know for yourself. And oftentimes, you know, there's that fine line of narcissism where, you know, enough about me, let's talk about me, you know. So there has to be a process by which people can have that opportunity to really articulate the inner, and it's the me, and that's appropriate. That's the beauty of therapy, you know, that therapist doesn't have to tell you their whole life story. You just get to talk to them. And that is part of the therapeutic model. And then there, you know, I think there comes a time when you've healed that need to be the center. And, you know, you've owned, Ken Wilber talks about, you can't transcend ego until you have a healthy ego. And so how do we really fully develop that in order to then become the servant of this broader sense of possibility? So I like what you said. That really is congruent with my experience. And I hadn't really positioned it in this whole kind of transformational model before. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would agree with Roger Walsh. And I mean, admittedly, and this is, I write this, the paper reporting the results of this study is under review for the International Journal of Transpersonal Studies. But one of the main limitations of it, of course, is the self-reporting bias. And that I think it is, you know, probably common that people maybe think they've changed more than they have, or that, you know, their own spouse or the people who know them best might not agree with how dramatic the changes are that they're reporting. You know, not that people, I tend to trust self-reporting, I think, a little bit more than some researchers. I think sometimes it gets downplayed too much, but I also totally recognize that we can be a little extra favorable when reporting about ourselves. But yeah, anyway.
Well, one thing you could look at in the data is the use of personal pronouns. So how, you know, do you notice a shift, or do you notice differences? So if you evaluate, these people seem to have these qualities that I think are positive, and these people are less so, are there ways in which their personal expression can be studied? And so I've found the use of pronouns to be very indicative of, you know, am I only talking about my first person pronoun, or am I using the we, or that intersubjective more often?
Interesting. I was lucky to have Roger Walsh as a guest on this podcast a few months ago now, but it was really special to hear him reflect on his marriage with Frances Fawn. And the way, I mean, these are two kind of giant scholars in the field of contemplative studies, and he just He admired her tremendously, of course. But I mean, to hear him talk about it was really meaningful. And so I like that was his answer to your question of how do you know if someone has transformed? I think he's being really honest about that. And I think it actually is a great gauge of transformation is to ask the people who know you best and who see you in all your forms. Okay. Loving this very much. So I would love to.
Well, I had the opportunity to be, so I was friends with them and,
all right.
And I had the opportunity to be at her memorial service and to remind him of that, because he had been, you know, what you just said, you know, so appreciative of her, and, you know, everybody was saying that. And I stood up and I said, you know, I just want to recall that moment when you said that. And it's really clear to me that from everything, she had been a transformed person, you know. And he has a very beautiful demeanor, and he'd be somebody I would put in that category over there of like, I want to study what he does. Mm. Because he does a lot of meditation. He goes off on these month-long meditation retreats and stuff. Mm. So not everybody can do that.
Right. So if I may, and just speak to him only how much you want to, but I would love to know what type of personal experience you've had with transformation. And I'll just be transparent right now to everyone listening. I didn't tell Dr. Schlitz I was going to ask her this. And so again, to the degree you feel comfortable talking about it, what has been your own experience with transformation?
Well, you know, certainly there's a lot of trauma that can go into that story. And, you know, a lot of experiences. I had a conversation at lunch the other day with a friend, and I'm like, oh yeah, well, I almost drowned 5 times. And she's like, what? And, you know, at some point I'm going to write about that, like these near drowning experiences, you know, because they just kind of get washed away literally in terms of a busy life. And you don't think about that kind of stuff. You know, I had a motorcycle accident where I had a out of body experience. And I also had a pretty intense recovery because I almost lost my leg, but I didn't. When I was 18 months old, I swallowed lighter fluid. And, you know, I was one of these precocious kids, and my father left it on the table, and I was like, okay, do what a good toddler does. And I put it in my mouth. And so that led me in and out of intensive care, and, you know, probably at an age before, you know, I have memory, but there was something deep in all of that. You know, being a parent is profound. There's nothing else like it, you know, because it's everything. And when it's going well, it is extraordinary. When it's not, they say you're only as happy as your least happy child. And so, you know, the work for me at this point really around that is individuation. You know, I have to own what I have the capacities to change and to know what I can't. And so, you know, I've really been focusing in terms of, you know, this pandemic and, you know, all of the challenges of that, you know, on my own communication. You know, I've done a lot of writing. I've gotten some, you know, publications out. I've participated in a number of these kind of podcasts and things. And that's something I can do and I like to do. And it makes me less obsessive about the things I can't change. And I think also then, you know, recognizing those foibles within us. It's like, okay to have those little loose threads. What is the word? The Japanese philosophy of you leave a little loose thread because the perfection is in the imperfection. And so I like that, you know, there's something very nurturing about that. And, you know, for me, probably the biggest practice that's helped me is gratitude. When you can shift from that anxiety, you know, suffering, self-absorption to gratitude, it just shifts you out of that and into a different framework. And again, you know, my thinking over, you know, the past half a decade maybe has become much more pragmatic about, you know, these little tiny things we can do. It doesn't require a massive overhaul. It requires, you know, pausing to smell the roses, you know, and in that moment, something shifts.
Mm. There's a section in your book, I think it's the subtitle is like the mystical and the mundane. I remember you reading about you those transformations that are kind of mystical and almost, you know, movie-like in a sense. They're very dramatic and romantic and almost stereotypical of the process of transformation. Like you recede into the wilderness and come out forever different, or you go on a meditation retreat. And that's a real thing. I've had my own versions of that. And then there's the mundane as well. And perhaps even, I suppose you could put it as perceiving the sacred in the mundane, almost in a way that the mundane is no longer mundane. But just this, I suppose that's somewhat related to what you're talking about now about the little things, the daily things.
The problem with the big things is you don't really reproduce those. So you go to a workshop and it's amazing. And then you go back to your life and it's back to that steady state. I work with Fred Luskin, and he told a story about this group of women from Northern Ireland. And they'd all lost a child in the conflict between, you know, the Catholics and the Protestants. And they all came to this workshop together, and they looked at emotional and social intelligence. They worked a lot on forgiveness, and they forged new friendships across those boundaries. But then they went home, and the communities didn't want that, you know, and they resisted that. And they estranged these people until they kind of converted back to, you know, who they were, at least in the public domain. Mm-hmm. So I had wanted to do research. I used to be on the board of Esalen. And I thought, wouldn't this be a great place to do a longitudinal study where we followed people who, you know, before they get to the workshop, they do a little survey, then they come to the workshop, and then we follow them, you know, a week, a month, and a year later. Now that would really be interesting to see how enduring the transformation is. And for a lot of people, I think it's just really hard to maintain it. And that's why people can become like workshop junkies. They go all the time, and, you know, that's, you ultimately, you know, that original quote, you know, we have to come into ourself. And it really is inspiring to us to go and do these other things, but the practice becomes important. And what constitutes a practice can be very individual, but it's the repetition and the building of the new muscles. You know, you're building new muscle groups, you're learning not to have those same triggers that came from your traumas, or, you know, all of that becomes really within your own capacity once you see it as yours.
Mm. Yeah. Makes sense. And it kind of comes back to those kind of four key elements of the transformative process that you were describing: intention, attention, repetition, guidance. Can you say?
And then the fifth being this acceptance, mm-hmm. surrender, mm-hmm. the acknowledgement. It may never be perfect.
Mm.
And that's the wabi-sabi. That's what they call it. Wabi-sabi. It's the wabi-sabi of life. There's going to be the perfection from the imperfection.
Hmm. Hmm. So can you say just a little bit more about kind of what it looks like to come back from, let's say, a workshop, meditation retreat, or even just any kind of dramatic shifting experience, to kind of return to the routine of daily life without simply reverting back to what daily life had always felt like? And so basically the question is, how do we integrate spiritual insight into daily life That's my question.
So one of my favorite teachers is Brother David Stendel-Rast, and he's a Benedictine monk. I've known him a long, long time. And he talks about how he went to Africa, and you know, his practice is gratefulness, and he's written several books about it, and he's kind of famous for it. So he went to Africa and he felt this overwhelming gratitude for clean drinking water. And then he went home and he turned on the tap and he felt this incredible gratitude for clean drinking water. And then a couple of days later, he turned on the tap and drank the water and he realized he'd kind of let it go. So he started putting these little yellow stick'em notes all over his house. And when he habituated to the stick'em notes, he moved them around. Or, you know, you think of the bobble-headed Buddha on the dashboard and you go, is that just some kind of new age kitsch thing that people are doing? But it's a reminder and it's just the little bobblehead. Oh yeah, I can center, you know? So it's little things again that I think can help us to remember. And that's where community can be helpful. Yeah. That's where the journaling can be helpful. Anything that's reinforcing, listening to podcasts. I think something, you know, like the TED Talks become just very inspiring for people as they listen to these amazing stories told well with authenticity. You know, that all is really, I think, great. We have a lot of opportunities, and it's probably, this is where I want to say again, you know, turn off the TV. Turn it on selectively and make sure that you maintain your awareness while you're watching it. Mm. You know, I noticed we turned it on last night, and just the tenor of the voices was kind of rattling me. So I'm like, I've seen what the news is. I know what's happening. Got the top stories. It's time to turn it off and just go back to, you know, my sense of groundedness. Yeah. So, you know, it's that balance. It's the integral. We've got to hold the integral. There's our inner, there's our cultural, there's our social, there's the evidence-based stuff that influences how, you know, we can know some aspects of what is true. All that's important.
A couple things come to my mind here. One is that I have much to learn, I'm sure, like from your teacher, for example, about the psychology of gratefulness and how to sustain that. And from what I've learned so far and what I've put into practice, sometimes I think that we don't highlight enough how powerful experiential contrast is in inducing a sense of gratitude. And your teacher's experience is a prime example. If a person never ever experiences difficulty accessing clean water, it's almost, you can't even expect them to think their way into being grateful for clean water. They simply know nothing different. And you can, I think, to some degree, a little bit, help them be grateful about that. But until they really know what it's like to not have it, their gratitude will always be, you know, somewhat minimal. But the moment you actually have a real contrast, it perspectives shift dramatically. And I sometimes think about the way that whenever I go camping, I enjoy camping. I don't mind sleeping on the ground, but my gratitude for the comfort of my bed after a few nights of camping is an experience that I don't think I could ever think my way into. I have to have this experiential contrast for it. And so I suppose it could be, this is helpful to kind of for people to think of it and just think, you know, if my gratitude practices don't feel very potent, maybe it's time that I get out of my comfort bubble and do things that are really uncomfortable, and take a cold shower so that I'm really grateful for warm water, or go camping, or skip a meal so I can really feel what hunger feels like and have gratitude for my food, or create some contrast in my perception that will keep my perspective in check.
Yeah, those are good things. And I think sometimes it doesn't have to be so extreme.
Fair.
And this is where the worldview issue comes in. You know, I need to own that I have worldview and that I have the capacity to see things this way or that way, like a dandelion. You know, it's very simple. It's something that manifests out of nature. And you go, wow. That awe and wonder piece is really powerful. I'm very interested in virtual reality now. And I've been working on this project of the psychomantium, which is a sensory deprivation procedure. And we use it as a vehicle for helping people to process grief. And we compare what it's like to be in a physical chamber where you have, it's a mirror gazing practice. And once you're in a sensory deprivation procedure and you gaze long enough, you start to kind of experience things. Mm-hmm. And whether it's auditory or visual or kinesthetic, you know, people report the tingles up the back of the neck or whatever it is. You know, there's this sense that they are experiencing something. And then the virtual reality piece, which is total immersion. And people have very profound experiences. So right now, I had this extraordinary experience. Here's like, you know, an example of my awe is I went the other day on Saturday. I've been trying to find a place to shoot a new VR 360 movie. And I couldn't get the place. And I finally, this guy called me back and he turned out to be, you know, really interesting fellow. And he took me to this theater and it was the perfect place to do what we needed to do. So then that night I go to dinner and I meet this new people. And it turns out he's like a filmmaker who actually designed a set just to do a sensory deprivation process. Because some actor in this television series he was working on just happened to be doing a immersion tank. I'm like, what is the probability of that? I'm like right now trying to get this little film thing together. And I meet this guy who is a master at creating the context for that specific kind of experience. I was like, wow. So that's, you know, one of those grateful moments where just now it kind of gives me a little tingle to think of the probabilities of that. That's like, seems pretty improbable, really. And wonderful, you know. But so what I wanted to say about the VR is, you know, I'm very interested in the developmental stages, as you've talked about, and aging. And as people become less mobile, less able to go camping, less able to do a cultural trip and exchange, you know, virtual reality becomes a really powerful tool for people to be able to go places and, you know, experience. And, you know, they're doing a lot with Alzheimer's now, you know, giving people the experiences of life 20 years earlier, for example, you know, because they have memories and they have feelings and they can begin to articulate things. So I am very excited about, you know, the simple, as it happens to be just our own inner process, but using technology now and these tools that we have provide an extension or reach of what our capacities are. And I think that's one of the real miracles of living at this time in history.
I love it. I myself have a VR headset, but I use it for, a friend of mine brought over a VR headset and he had a boxing game on it. So you literally, like, you're throwing punches, you're boxing, and it feels immersive. No doubt. And the graphics are only going to improve. So it's going to feel all the more immersive. But yeah, so, and I've seen some of these like games, I guess you could call them, or platforms where you can make it feel like you're walking along a walkway in France or in any place in the world. And yeah, so I can only imagine how valuable that would be for someone who's immobile. And the thing about it is that it really does stimulate you. You know, like there's another game, for example, where you're on a canoe and you're you know, paddling along, and then a fish will jump over your boat and you really jump back and your heart rate spikes. And so it truly is stimulating. I'm sure many people listening have tried it, but maybe not. And yeah, it's worth a try. It's immersive enough to be, give you like an experience, like you're really there. So that's interesting and neat that you're interested in that.
Well, I will invite you to participate in my experiment and anybody else who has a VR setup, because we are, once we get this little movie done, it will be a little portable experiment. So what we do is we assess certain psychological paper and pencil kind of tests. And we ask people to do a short journaling, because I'm very interested in journaling and personal expression. And then we have them go through the psychomantium experience and then do a repeat of all the assessments. And that's, you know, the before and after measures. But it's something that it will be portable. We would just send you a link and you'd be able to download it. And anybody who has a little phone, you know, we can provide the cardboard masks, but people who have their own experience will be able to download it. And, you know, we're really interested in how this kind of thing can have a transformative potential and it can be a healing tool. So that's cool.
Well, I'll stay tuned for whenever an invitation goes out, because, so let me get this straight. You're creating a virtual reality version of the psychomantium. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Oh, correct. My goodness.
So people will come into the chamber, they'll sit down, there's a mirror, they gaze into the mirror, and then why we wanted a big space is because when you turn around, it's all going to be blackness. Mm-hmm. You'll be immersed in the blackness, mm-hmm. except for the illumination on the mirror. And then we developed one prior to this, but it was tethered to a big computer. And so I wanted to liberate it from the computer. But that one, we had the person go out of body and they actually moved into the mirror. And then we let it go from there. And, you know, you invite people's active imaginations to take over from that.
Mm. And if I'm remembering correctly, when you don't see your own reflection in the mirror, is that right? It's tilted in a way where you don't see your reflection, right?
Exactly. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I could see how this would translate to VR then. Wow, fascinating.
Yeah. So yeah, stay tuned. There's lots of great stuff happening and I will do the same with you. It's, you know, was that your dissertation, the research you described, or?
It was not actually. No, this was just research I got approved by through Sophia University by Fred Luskin and just conducted kind of on my own with a great group of people, a couple of whom studied at Sophia and another one who's at CSU Monterey Bay, and we hired a statistician. So we had a team of five of us and conducted, I think what turned out to be a really interesting study.
Sounds like it. Sounds great. Now, good luck on the publication.
Thank you.
I'll look forward to reading it. Yeah.
Perfect. Great. Well, yeah, I'm so glad we're connected. I believe we're sitting on the same dissertation committee for somebody. So I'm sure we'll have some upcoming interactions anyway.
Okay.
So very happy we're connected. And I just
Really, thank you. Doing this work, it really is part of the process. I think people knowing they're not alone, that's often actually, you know, one of the things we found when I was working at the Institute of Noetic Sciences is, you know, people thought they were the only ones who had these experiences. And in fact, many, many, many people have them.
Mm.
And to be able to, you know, reassure people. Again, that's part of the healing. It's part of the connecting. So I'm very grateful for you for what you're doing, and I wish you all the best. And what
I feel that, and I just want to say to the audience, to the people who are listening, thank you so much for staying tuned in. I'm so glad that the conversation was worth your time and attention. And yeah, to you again, Dr. Schlitz, thank you for joining us. And just letting people know that we have a few podcasts lined up to publish. So I'm trying to remember exactly which episode this will be. It'll be like number 28 or 29. And this all started from a friend and I co-creating videos, putting them onto this YouTube channel. And then the podcast was just born out of that. but it's been so enjoyable. And I've had the opportunity to talk to amazing, intelligent, wise people. So you fit right into the theme. And I just, yeah, encourage everyone who's listening to whatever platform you're listening on, subscribe, follow along, stay tuned for upcoming episodes because we have many to come. We'll continue doing this. So with that, great. I'll sign off and thank you one more time, Dr. Schlitz. And I hope everyone has a wonderful day.